Motivation is a very emotional state, and the great physical and mental motivators in life, such as survival and hunger and thirst and revenge and love, are all charged with emotion. The two key emotions which dominate all human motivation with opposite but nearly equally effective results are fear and desire. Fear is the most powerful negative motivator of all. Fear is the great compeller and the great inhibitor. Fear restricts and tightens and panics, forces and ultimately scuttles plans and defeats goals. And desire, conversely, is like a strong positive magnet. It attracts and reaches, opens and directs, and encourages and achieves goals. Fear and desire are poles apart, and they lead to alternate destinies in life. Fear always looks to the past, and desire toward the future. Fear vividly replays haunting experiences of failure, of pain, of disappointment, or unpleasantness, and is a dogged reminder that the same experiences are likely to repeat themselves. But desire, on the other hand, triggers memories of pleasure and success. It excites the need to replay these and to create new winning experiences. The consuming prison words of the fearful person are likely to be, I have to, I can't, I see risk, and I wish. But desire says, I want to, I can, I see opportunity, and I will. Desire is that emotional state between where you are and where you want to be. So desire is a magnetic tension like a bow pulled taut to shoot the arrow to the bullseye. Is tension good or bad? Yes, it is good or bad depending on how you look at it. Negative tension induced by fear creates distress, anxiety, sickness, and hostility. Carried to extremes, it can cause psychosis and even death. But positive tension produced by desire is like that bow pulled taut to propel the arrow to the bullseye. Fear causes compulsion stress. Desire causes propulsion power. Fear causes inhibition stress, and desire causes ignition power. In a totally tension-free state, you're either asleep or dead. Viktor Frankl, the noted psychiatrist, flatly states that what a person really needs in life is not a tension-free state, but the striving and struggling for a goal that is worthy of him or her. The winners in life respond positively to pressures in life, whether they're executives, educators, doctors, nurses, athletes, or homemakers. The winners have learned how to concentrate on the desired results rather than possible problems. And winners dwell on the rewards of success and not the penalties of failure. You know, there's an old story that you may remember that graphically demonstrates what I'm talking about. Let's see if you remember it. If I were to put a plank 2 feet wide and 20 feet long on the floor, I put a $10 bill on one end and offer it as a reward to a friend if he or she can walk the length of the plank, 1 foot after the other, without stepping off on the floor and pick up the $10 bill. No sweat. Easy function, sufficient reward, low risk. Simple to walk 1 foot after the other for 20 feet. But let's say I put one end of the plank on the roof of a 20-story building and the other end on the roof of an adjacent 20-story building. And I put a pebble on the $10 bill just in case there's a slight breeze. And now we ask the friend to walk the plank just as before to pick up another easy $10 bill. Would they do it? Not on their life. Maybe for $1,000 they'd shinny across. Suddenly a new element has entered the performance. 20 stories of or else, or fear. As you begin to walk the plank, a relatively easy task, no longer is the reward of success the incentive. The penalty of failure looms as a neon sign beckoning, and your legs tighten up, and you step with excruciating care, unsteady, in need of a balancing pole. Fear of the penalty of failure takes hold and makes the most simple task of walking straight almost impossible to perform. And so it is with all of life's activities. Dwell on the reward, and you move confidently toward the reward. But dwell on the penalty, and you move hesitantly, but just as surely, toward the penalty. You know, there's a great classic true story involving baseball that's a perfect example. The World Series in the 1950s. New York Yankees, Milwaukee Braves. Warren Spahn, the great Milwaukee left-handed pitcher, on the mound. Elston Howard, the great Yankee catcher, at the plate. Score tied, 2 men on, 2 men out, 3-2, a critical part of the series, and a critical part of the game. The manager walks out of the dugout to give Warren Spahn, the great pitcher, some encouraging, motivating advice. "Don't give him a high outside pitch. He'll knock it out of the park," said the manager, and walked back to the dugout. Warren Spahn said to himself, "Why did he have to say it to me in that way? Let's see, don't give him a high outside pitch. The reverse of that is too late." Like a neon sign, high and outside came as the dominant message. Out of the park went the ball, a three-run homer. Because of that one dominant thought, Milwaukee almost lost the World Series. But Eddie Matthews came in with a home run to save the game and the series for the Braves. Warren Spahn to this day says, "Why would anyone ever try to motivate anyone with the reverse of what they want?" And so it is with all of life's confrontations. You tell your children, "Clean up your room, you little pigs." And what do you get? You're right. You get a pigsty. And the kids say, oink, oink. Remind them enough, and they know who they are. That's like motivating an office staff by saying, "Firings will continue until morale improves." You know, it just won't work. I know many coaches who unwittingly set up their players for losing performances every day. Here's an example in basketball. "Missing free throws is what loses big games, team," yells the coach. "You're all going to stay late during practice and shoot free throws until you stop missing them so often." Well, a winning coach would take advantage of the positive motivation opportunity by saying, "Teams with high free throw averages win ball games. I want you to put an extra 15 minutes a day making your free throws in practice so that when we get them during next week's game, we'll make all we can and we'll win the game." You see, this is the right way to motivate. Fear motivation should be reserved for physical danger imminent or wartime situation or last resort. Keep your head down or you'll get it shot off. Don't run in the street or you'll get hit. Don't touch the flame or you'll get burned. If there is danger to health and safety, use fear motivation. If you've tried every incentive and desire motivation possibility and you still can't get positive movement forward, then use a modified fear motivation approach. For example, you've tried everything to get higher productivity out of an employee in a key position. The last resort is to call him or her in the office and say, "I'm giving you a one-month opportunity to improve the quality and quantity of your production, which I fully expect you to do. You have the skills and the talent. Unless you meet the targets we've set, I'll help you make arrangements for seeking employment elsewhere." Remember, fear can stop bad behavior, but it's no good for trying to continue positive behavior. It's like putting a gun to someone's head and saying, "Relax, do your best, and nobody will get hurt." I remember an interesting day in Aspen, Colorado, when I was learning how to ski. I went up the wrong chairlift, and I ended up on a ski run with a black diamond symbol in front of it marked expert. "Why not?" I smiled, fantasizing that an older version of Billy Johnson was being reborn on the slopes. I should have looked more closely at the name of the ski run. It was appropriately called Adios, which in this case meant goodbye pronto. My original image of the desired result quickly turned into stark terror as I considered the penalty of failure, a compound fracture of the fibula, a possible broken neck, and a tree implant. Falling on a ski slope is inevitable. However, it is the dominant thought and the motivation at the time of the fall that means everything. Losers panic and fall toward the uphill ski, thereby risking a broken ankle and serious injury. But winners relax and fall down or roll down the hill and pick themselves up, brush themselves off, put on their skis, and do it all over again. But it's hard to do that when you're in a full body cast. You know, I'm learning to read ski run signs much better